From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jay McInerney is one of the novelists who felt that fiction had lost much of its meaning after September 11th. He abandoned the novel he was working on and started volunteering at Ground Zero. But he went back to fiction, and the result has just been published. His new novel, The Good Life, is about two Manhattan couples whose marriages have gone stale. After September 11th, they reevaluate their lives. But although September 11th may have changed everything, it's often difficult to really change your own life. And that's one of the things we'll talk about with Jay McInerney. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews First Impressions of Earth, the third album by The Strokes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After September 11th, novelist Jay McInerney felt that fiction had lost its power and relevance, so he gave up on the novel he was writing. Eventually, he went back to fiction and started a new book. That book has just been published. It's called The Good Life, and September 11th plays a prominent part in it. Set in Manhattan, the novel is about two couples who appear to be at dead ends in their marriages. As the saying goes, September 11th changed everything. The novel follows these characters as they reevaluate their lives, try to make some major changes, and face the consequences. Jay McInerney first became known for his 1984 novel Bright Lights, Big City, about a young magazine fact-checker who gets caught up in the club scene and cocaine. Let's start with a reading from The Good Life. It's the Sunday after September 11th. Luke is about to sit down with his wife and teenage daughter for their traditional Sunday meal of takeout food.
With his body clock so out of whack, downtown in flames, the schedule of office life now a receding memory, Luke didn't think he would notice Sunday as such, didn't think he would feel the usual suck of low-grade depression. Hard to believe that the rhythms of the week could be so internalized that this particular Sunday would register as anything except the fifth day of an entirely new calendar. Perhaps the muted feeling of letdown had as much to do with the sense of receding crisis as when, a few days after the funeral of a loved one, the narcotic of shock wears off and the sense of surviving from moment to moment gives way to the realization that you will simply have to carry on with the routines of daily life as if nothing had happened. He knew he was lucky to be alive, but he felt distinctly unworthy of this gift. These last few days, instead of light and blessed and spared, he'd been feeling borne down by the burden of it as the roll call of the noble, hapless victims unscrolled on television and in the papers. He'd been scared senseless most of the hours he'd spent downtown and haunted by nightmares ever since, but he felt so utterly useless up here on 77th Street that he now wished he'd stayed. As if he belonged somewhere, even inside that toxic cloud behind the blue police barriers, a feeling that he hadn't had in a long time since he'd become bored with his job and disaffected with his life.
That's Jay McInerney reading from his new novel, The Good Life. Jay, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Your novel is about how September 11th does and doesn't change the lives of your characters, and it's also about how they do and don't want September 11th to change their lives. Why did you want to write about that aspect of change?
Well, it seemed to me, first of all, that, you know, those of us in New York in particular had experienced something extraordinary and something presumably life-transforming. At first, I think my response was to feel that fiction was almost impossible, that it was irrelevant, that it was frivolous. I think in the immediate aftermath of the event, I couldn't imagine writing fiction, writing a novel. Finally, nine months later, as the feelings of that moment really began to recede, it seemed to me that something extraordinary had happened and that it was well worth trying to record. And I think one of the things that happened was that many, many people in New York, many of my friends, acquaintances, certainly, in the wake of that event, imagined or tried to imagine new lives, or tried to or reevaluated their old lives. I think we were all reevaluating, and certainly for a moment, transformation seemed possible.
Possible.
Possible. Yeah.
But not necessarily. Your novel examines the possibility and then, like, well, what happens with that possibility? How possible is the possibility?
Well, change is difficult. But I think that I really do believe that many people incrementally change their lives, that they were nudged towards some slightly higher state of awareness. And even if that awareness receded, even if the changes were somewhat rolled back over time, I do believe that a lot of us will never be quite the same.
One of the things you were up against as a novelist is writing about an experience that has already been so well recorded. You know, what happened September 11th, what Manhattan looked like after September 11th, how it changed a lot of lives. Mm-hmm. There's been magazine and newspaper articles and TV news reports and documentaries and so on. Did you ask yourself, what can I add to an event that has already been so well chronicled?
I did. And in fact, almost every day that I was writing this book, I decided that I'd taken on a foolish and hopeless task, and berated myself constantly, even as I pressed forward. At the same time, I felt that I had been there, and in fact, I worked at a soup kitchen at Ground Zero for almost 2 months. I felt that I had a perspective that was, if not unique, that was vivid and powerful enough that it might, it might add to the sum of the record of that time, I guess. I also felt that, you know, for all of the millions of words that had been spent on this, that had all of the newspaper columns and the magazine coverage and the broadcast coverage, that it seemed to me that none of this really stuck in the mind, that no one had really sort of created a narrative, a sort of coherent story that really captured that moment, and that it was just it was like a thousand details floating like floating almost like the paper that rained down on us from the towers that day, and it seemed to me that there was room for a narrative like that.
Your new novel, The Good Life, centers around two different couples. Mm-hmm. One thing they have in common is that their marriage has started to chill. Neither of the couples make love much anymore. After September 11th, the wife from one couple and the husband from another couple accidentally meet near Ground Zero. And they feel this great connection to each other. They have an affair with each other, and it seems to be, on both of their parts, a very deeply felt love. As a writer, you had to decide, is this the big change that they're going to follow through on after September 11th? Are they going to end their marriages, mm-hmm. uproot their children's lives, and pursue a permanent relationship? Or will this affair end? Can you talk a little bit about how you decided what kind of fate to give this romance that you started up, and why? You mean, because in so many stories, romance is the bottom line. You know, the victory means romance conquers all. Romance wins.
I would like to think that I haven't closed the door in this book on romance conquering all, but I think that it would have been far too simplistic to wrap it up in a bow at this particular point. I also think I don't know. I don't want to belabor this point, but I think there was, you know, I think that there's something to my mind somewhat metaphoric about their romance, and in fact, this book is really about that extraordinary heightened state of consciousness that so many people experienced in the aftermath of 9/11, and of course, love is a heightened state of consciousness, and that sense of heightened awareness ultimately faded, and I think I don't know. I think that I saw the romance as sort of intricately entwined with the mood of that time.
These two people who fall in love, they are both working at Ground Zero, helping to give food to, you know, the firemen and the police there. Is that the kind of work you did at Ground Zero after September 11th?
Yeah, very, very simple and basic stuff. I, you know, made coffee, made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and I went uptown and solicited donations from restaurants. I have a lot of friends in the restaurant business, and I would get, you know, 50 rigatoni dinners here and 50 burgers there, and bring them downtown for the for the rescue workers, the firemen, the policemen, the iron workers. It was interesting, though, that everybody at that, you know, the most popular stuff at that time seemed to be the comfort food, the stuff that we all associated with childhood. The peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and the chicken noodle soup those were undoubtedly the two favorite dishes down there. You know, I mean, I was kind of knocking myself out to provide some real gourmet fare from uptown restaurants, and a lot of times it was, you know, it was the peanut butter and jelly and ham and cheese sandwiches that went first.
My guest is Jay McInerney. His new novel is called The Good Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jay McInerney. His new novel, The Good Life, follows two couples just before and just after September 11th. The characters in your novel are, for the most part, pretty wealthy, very well connected to either the fashion world or the literary world. I mean, one of the couples is probably living a little above their means.
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But these are people who are really well connected. They know all the writer celebrities. They mm-hmm. know a lot of the big directors, one of the couples they really know the fashion world, and it seems to be a world that you like to chronicle in your books. What do you and there's a lot of people who dismiss that and say, yeah. Oh, Jay McInerney, he writes about the people who are rich and privileged, the beautiful mm-hmm. people. Who cares about that? And that's a sign of his character defect as mm-hmm. as a writer, because he writes about I'm people who are unworthy.
uh-huh.
So I'd love to hear your answer to that. You know, when people like dismiss your characters because mm-hmm. they're from a privileged or at least a relatively privileged world.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to say that, you know, the main characters in this novel, as in my 1992 novel, Brightness Falls, which is where they first make their appearance, are members of the culture-producing class. Russell Calloway is a book editor, and is not a very highly paid profession, I hasten to add. His wife is an aspiring screenwriter, essentially, not a successful screenwriter, and Russell is a member of you know, the New York chattering class, and but I think that because he's highly educated, because he's highly literate, as is his wife, these people to me they're not shallow people. They may, you know, they may be superficial in certain ways, as we all are, but they are highly self-conscious, reflective individuals living at the sort of pinnacle of civilization. Luke McGavick, the other protagonist in the novel, is a retired investment banker. I'm personally very interested in someone who is, in a, you know, basically working at the center of the economic engine that drives New York and the nation, for that matter, who powers the machine that drives drives the rest of the city. Really, I mean, all of the culture, all of the art, all of the nightlife that we have in New York actually is sort of financed by Wall Street, in a sense. And so I have to say I find these characters eminently interesting, eminently complex, and you know, I have to say they're my friends and neighbors. This is the world I live in, and it's a world that I've chosen to chronicle.
Well, and literally, in a way, some of them are your friends and neighbors. I mean, you mention a lot of people you know by name in the book. Salman Rushdie, Paul Auster. I don't know if you know Martha Stewart personally, but she's in the book, too, in a little cameo.
I've forgotten Martha's in there. Okay.
Yeah, so is this a good thing or a bad thing for the people you know? Are they glad to be cameos in your book, or do you ever say something that gets you into trouble. For instance, like the woman who's the aspiring screenwriter says, I just told Paul Auster that he needs to focus more on plots, that he should read. I forget who she recommends that he read, but so he gets a finer sense of plotting.
I think John Grisham.
John Grisham, yes, exactly. So, I don't know if Paul Auster would be thrilled to read that.
It certainly doesn't reflect badly on him, I think.
It says something about her?
I'm sure that Paul has heard this kind of drivel before, as I have. So, it's more of a reflection on his interlocutor than it is on him. I would hasten to add that, Russell is an editor and a publisher, and this is the world he lives in. And it seems to me that, there's a certain amount of veracity here, a certain amount of locating the reader it's important, I think, when you're writing about the city, when you're writing about contemporary life, to somehow define your fictional universe and its relation to the real New York City, which is chronicled in the Times and the Post every day, and that we're all walking around in, that's my way of situating us.
I want to read something that Louis Menand wrote in The New Yorker in a review of your book. He said, it's a feature of the characters in McInerney's novel that they see themselves as characters in a McInerney novel. This makes them depressed. Corrine knows that being a downtown mom trying to resuscitate her career by writing or pretending to write a screenplay is a cliché. Luke knows that all ex-investment bankers are supposed to be idly pursuing some sophomoric project in the name of personal growth. This character is actually writing about samurai films, which he loves.
Right, right.
And Menand says, these characters are all in a bubble, and they feel it, but they can't get out. It is this noble but futile resistance to the types in which they have been cast that earns them their creator's affection. And part of what he's saying here, and I think this is really true, that the characters examine their own lives, and they say, I'm a cliché. What I'm doing now is like a cliché. But it is what they're doing.
It is.
So what happens when...
But I think that's only because they are more self-aware than most people walking around on the street.
Precisely.
I don't think that's necessarily a function of their unique limitations so much as their unique awareness of their hyper awareness, their media savvy, they're extremely well read. They're too self-conscious by half. And this is one of the things I find interesting about these types of people. I'm not sure I'd go so far as to agree that they know that they're in a McInerney novel, although I think it's a funny idea.
but that's the thing. If you're self-aware enough to examine your life and say about your life, this is a cliche, then what?
Have you ever
felt that way? Have you ever looked at your life and thought, I'm a cliche?
Well, certainly, I've certainly looked at my life and said I'm a stereotype. I have a public persona, which Menand is sort of alluding to there as well, that sometimes feels like a prison. The sort of bad boy novelist who wrote Bright Lights, Big City and then seemed to be living it out in public. I felt trapped in that cliche to some extent, and I've been trying to struggle my way out of it for some time. It's particularly confining when it was a stereotype that was created, more than 20 years ago for you. we all do grow and change. But even if you know even if you feel that you're living a cliche, I think there's a simple answer to your question, or I can think of at least one question, and that is romance and romantic love. And I think that this is Luke McGavick and Corrine Calloway's solution to that dilemma, or this is the road out of that feeling of of being trapped in preconceived forms.
Jay McInerney, his new novel is called The Good Life. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how middle age is changing his life and writing. We continue our conversation with Jay McInerney, and Ken Tucker reviews the third album by The Strokes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with novelist Jay McInerney, the author of Bright Lights, Big City, The Last of the Savages, and Brightness Falls. His new novel, The Good Life, follows two couples just before and just after September 11th. We were talking before about how your book is in part about the ways in which lives were changed after September 11th, mm-hmm. and some of the things people tried to do to consciously change their lives, having reevaluated their mm-hmm. lives in the aftermath of September 11th. You had just been separated from your wife
yes.
before September mm-hmm. 11th, so you were dealing with that at the time, and I'm wondering if you're comfortable talking about it, how that affected what you saw when you took stock of your life after September 11th.
Well, when I took stock initially, my impulse was to, I suppose my first impulse was to flee the city, to return to the bosom of my family, to go back in time, as it were. And it was something that I thought long and hard about, and ultimately I wasn't successful in that. In that attempt, but
and where was home?
Well, my ex-wife and I had been sort of dividing our time between Tennessee and New York, and then she chose to move back to Tennessee when we got divorced. So there was a real temptation, to flee the city. Because of my peripatetic upbringing, I really didn't have any roots. But so Tennessee was the closest thing I could think of, and I tried, and ultimately failed. I think that there were an awful lot of valiant attempts made after September 11th to do what seemed to be the noble thing, the ideal thing, the sort of safe and comfortable thing, that is to say, to retreat, to hunker down. And I think as some of these changes, some of these attempts were successful, perhaps mine wasn't.
When you say to return to family, you went back with your wife, is that what you're saying?
No, I didn't actually go back with my I tried to.
Right.
It's complicated, but I think we both agreed after talking long and hard about it that that I couldn't do it.
So that is in part what the novel's about, don't you think? Yes, about the things you feel like you should do in the face of this.
Yeah, I think that
works and what doesn't.
I think the novel is a sort of my encoded sort of version of all of this. You know, sometimes I think I would have saved myself a great deal of effort if I'd just written it straight. You know, I mean, in some ways, Luke does all the things that I didn't do, but I wasn't comfortable writing straight from that directly from my own experience.
The main characters in the Good Life were created in your previous novel.
Yes,
Brightness Falls.
Brightness Falls.
Why did you want to bring them into your new novel? Why not start fresh?
Brightness Falls is my favorite of my books, and Russell and Corinne Calloway, the protagonists of that novel. I have to say, always seemed to me kind of a representative couple in some way. They were the sort of, you know, the golden couple, the high school, the college sweethearts who went to the city and who made matrimony seem attractive from the outside, and they were living out the dream of a young couple moving to New York and making their way, succeeding. I guess I always wanted to follow up with them. I'm a great admirer of John Updike's Rabbit Angstrom series. To me, it's just a tremendous achievement, and to watch Rabbit, to follow him decade by decade through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, to watch him grow old and ultimately die. This was something that seemed wonderful and rich to me, and I'd always planned to revisit these characters. I also think they're my most complex, most fully realized characters. When I was thinking about writing a novel that chronicled the responses to the events of 9/11, it suddenly seemed natural that they would be among the characters.
In part because you knew them so well?
I felt, yes, honestly, I felt like I knew them very well. And I was I was interested in what they'd been up to since I had last visited them, and I just had a fairly vivid sense of where what they would be doing and where they were, and it was something I really wanted to do. I wanted to revisit them
for reasons I'll explain in a moment. I'd like to end our interview with a reading from the final paragraph of Brightness Falls, the novel that you wrote just before The Good Life. So would you read the last few lines of that for us?
Indeed. This is from the end of the novel. Russell Calloway is falling asleep and meditating on, among other things, the death of his best friend Jeff Pierce. It seems to him as if they are taking a course in loss lately. And as he feels himself falling asleep, he has an insight he believes is important, which he hopes he will remember in the morning, although it is one of those thoughts that seldom survive translation to the language of daylight hours. knowing that whatever plenty befalls them, together or separately in the future, they will become more and more intimate with loss as the years accumulate. Friends dying or slipping away undramatically into the crowded past, memory itself finally flickering and growing treacherous toward the end. Knowing that even the children who may be in their future will eventually school them in the pain of growth and separation as their own parents and mentors die off and leave them alone in the world, shivering at the dark threshold.
The reason why I wanted to end with that, in addition to the fact that I think it's a really beautifully written passage, is that the loss that he expects to continue to face, he does face in the new book in ways that he couldn't possibly have imagined. And I'm not sure that you imagined that the ending of that book would be exactly the door into the new one.
It is strange to me. The other thing I was just thinking about as I was reading that was that a part of the backdrop to that passage, it was the stock market crash of 1987, in which Russell loses a lot of money and loses control of a company he was trying to take over. And it just suddenly occurred to me that seemed like a relatively cataclysmic event at the time, and it really pales in comparison to the cataclysm that I'm writing about.
In thinking about the past, Russell refers to the crowded past. I really like that a lot, because the older you get, the more crowded the past becomes.
Yeah. Even as the faces perhaps become less distinct. I have to admit I labored a little over that passage. There isn't an undeliberate word there.
What does laboring over that passage mean? What did you do when you were laboring? Like, how often did you rewrite it? How often did you go back? How much time would you let elapse before going back to it?
Well, it's hard to remember exactly, but this book went through at least three drafts, and actually it was my most labor intensive book. It was about 4 years that I worked on Brightness Falls. I initially conceived it as being shorter and less complicated, and my friend and mentor Raymond Carver had an expression he always liked to say that writing is rewriting, and by which he meant that, you know, for him the writing process really began with the second draft, when you had the, you know, when it was like when you'd cleared a path. And then you could really begin to focus on language and detail and rhythm and nuance. And I think that's true to some extent. Of course, every once in a while, you know, we commit a sentence which is, you know, comes fully formed, or a paragraph which comes fully formed and sparkles and shines. But I think for me, I would agree with Carver that that writing is rewriting, and this passage didn't come to me in a flash of flash of inspiration. Although thankfully, I can't remember all the labor that went into it now.
Is seeing writing as rewriting liberating in a way, because it takes the burden off of the first draft?
Yeah.
You could write anything.
Yeah,
you
I think,
let it come out. Know
I think
you can reshape it.
I think one of the reasons I remember that so well is because it was so useful at the time. Because I think, like many many beginning writers, I was sort of just crippled by a sense of the momentousness of you know, committing yourself to a sentence, to a paragraph, to a story, you know, worrying whether you were going down the right path, worrying whether you were making the right choice, and you know, Carver's dictum was, you know, just get it down, get black on white, as Maupassant said, and then you can go back and make it sing, and it was liberating. And I think it's a good piece of advice.
My guest is Jay McInerney. His new novel is called The Good Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jay McInerney. His new novel, The Good Life, follows two couples just before and just after September 11th. You mentioned Raymond Carver as your mentor. Gary Fiskejohn has been your editor forever, right?
Yep.
What role does he play in your life as your editor?
Well, Gary Fiskejohn was a friend of mine from Williams College, and we started trading books back in 1975.
Books that you were reading?
Yeah, we kind of, in a sense, grew up together in the literary sense. We took a course on Ulysses together, which was a very important book for us. I remember lending him Raymond Carver's first book, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, which just took the top of my head off. I often thought that reading that book in 1976 was a little bit like it must have been to read In Our Time, you know, Hemingway's early collection of stories. And Gary subsequently became Raymond Carver's editor. So we had really been shaping each other's literary sensibilities to some extent for many years when Gary became an editor at Random House eventually published my first novel, Bright Lights, Big City. He plays a big role. Gary's the person I show the first draft to. In the case of The Good Life, I was baffled because I couldn't quite figure out after 500 pages what I was attempting when I finished a draft, and I gave it to Gary, and I remember he scratched his head too, and unfortunately he wasn't quite sure what I was up to. Subsequently, when I finally knew where I was going, when I gave Gary the first draft, he gives it an extremely thorough read. We often end up arguing about sentences, arguing about punctuation. Sometimes it gets loud and violent almost.
Can you remember the argument over a sentence?
I can't think of an example right now. But I can tell you that ultimately he will fight me for what he believes, and then ultimately sometimes I think that his goal as an editor is economy, and sometimes I think mine as a writer is rhythm. And those are, you know, those can be different goals. But ultimately he says to me, it's your name on the book. The other thing I can remember is that, he fought hard for this title. I doubted it for a while, and I thought the title was a little provocative.
The title's The Good Life.
The Good Life. Well, yes, a reviewer named Benjamin Strong said in the Village Voice this week, in what was a very, a very nice review. It started off in what for me was scary fashion. He said, something to the effect that, a book called The Good Life from the well-known self-dramatizing hedonist Jay McInerney could be a dangerous thing. But Gary was very fond of the title all the way and kept telling me the ways in which it was the right title for this book. And I ultimately believed him in those regards. Well, I think all of the characters are in this book are, in one way or another, asking themselves what constitutes the good life. What is the well lived life? And of course, the title is also ironic because certainly we have people like Luke and Sasha McGavick, very very wealthy Manhattanites, going to all the right parties and wearing all the right clothes. Certainly they would seem to be living a cliche of the good life. I think it's a pretty rich title, and I don't know. I suppose it could be an overarching title for a lot of my work.
You had mentioned that at Ground Zero, when you were helping to get food to the firefighters and police, you were trying to round up gourmet meals from the people in the food world that you knew, what people really wanted was comfort food, chicken soup, peanut butter. There's a character in your new novel who has a peanut butter sandwich for the first time in a long time, and it sets off this like monumental, revelatory flashback about his childhood. Did anything happen to you when you found yourself eating peanut butter at Ground Zero?
Yeah. I was just thinking of it now. I started to cry.
Why?
Because I hadn't had it in so long. It was my childhood. And I don't specifically associate it with the kind of traumatic event that Luke did, but I had not had peanut butter since I was, I hadn't had peanut butter and jelly since I was 12 or 13 years old, and it just catapulted me back to that moment. And I think, you know, I have a have a son who's now almost that age, and I think I just remembered how scary it was being, how difficult it was being that age. It was just an overwhelming emotional response. I just had the hardest time figuring it out or explaining to people why I was crying as I was eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But then again, that was a time when there was a lot of raw emotion, and it was... people were bursting into tears all the time, I guess, but that was my little epiphany, even if it didn't have a really specific narrative content. Suddenly I was 12 years old again. I was feeling very vulnerable and scared.
Which is probably how you were feeling as an adult at that moment too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was extraordinary. I'm just thinking of all those of so many of those moments, and nobody had to explain themselves when they started crying as they were serving coffee or soup or rigatoni. It was, as I said, a time of real heightened awareness, and I think that, you know, it was interesting. It was sort of like an earthquake. Where suddenly all these like sediments of memory were exposed, as if in a big sort of fault line. Suddenly something could carry you back to your childhood that way, back to some other trauma, back to some other incredibly vivid moment in your life. And that's part of what I was trying to capture in the book.
Jay McInerney, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jay McInerney's new novel is called The Good Life. Coming up, The Strokes have a new CD, and Ken Tucker has a review. This is Fresh Air. First Impressions of Earth is The Strokes' third album. When the band released its debut in 2001, they were hailed as the group that would reestablish New York City as the center of post-punk rock, fast, loud, and flashy. But after selling over 2 million copies of that debut, their follow-up, 2003's Room on Fire, sold only half as much. Rock critic Ken Tucker says The Strokes' new album offers some self-criticism and some frantic career adjustment in the midst of the music.
We'll be right back. That song, Razorblade, is typical of the Strokes' current sound. Lead singer and songwriter Julian Casablancas' hoarse voice can be heard more clearly than ever over the chiming guitars of Albert Hammond Jr. and Nick Valensi. The song itself practically begs to be misinterpreted. The refrain, "My feelings are more important than yours," isn't what the singer is telling his girlfriend. They're a quote from her to him. He's the selfish one, and the point is to let her have her say in this song. It's good to hear Casablancas get outside his own head, and the song is nicely confusing. Less confusing is the pattern the album falls into as it proceeds. Upbeat tunes for downbeat emotions. Oh, what an unhappy boy our Casablancas is. That song, called On the Other Side, is a litany of dissatisfaction. I'm tired of everyone I know, moans Casablancas, of everyone I see on the street and on TV. He says, I hate them all, and I hate myself for hating them. I'm so tired of being so judgmental, he concludes. It's a downer, but it's surrounded by a jaunty melody that gives the singer's depression a buoyant lift. Similarly, on this song called Ask Me Anything, Casablancas croons the refraining phrase, I've got nothing to say, with such lovely sincerity, it becomes less a proclamation of creative bankruptcy than a shrewd self-assessment. You've gotta like a rock lyricist who sings, we could drag it out, but that's for other bands to do.
Right, wrong, what to do, someday it will come to you. Style Indians, we named a summer camp for you. I've got nothing to say. 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 I've got nothing to say.
The notion of having nothing to say pops up again and again on First Impressions of Earth, most forcefully on the rave-up closeout of the album, Red Light. The band is collaborating with a new producer, David Kahn, a veteran who's worked with pop acts ranging from the Bangles to Sugar Ray. Kahn has tidied up the Strokes' sound, which most often has been as mussed and bedraggled as their hair. The Strokes' history is as much about image-making as it is about music-making. One of them dates Drew Barrymore, another has had well-publicized struggles with alcohol. Glam and dissolution were what the first two albums were about, if they were about anything. These guys who attended posh Manhattan prep schools, who idolized the New York Dolls and the Ramones, who emulated the short, fast, sharp style of 30 years ago, are now writing some songs that run well over 4 minutes. Some call it progress. I call it an interesting way to come to grown-up terms with semi-sobriety and an urge to become more nuanced about their artistic ambivalence. For a guy who insists he's got nothing left to say, Julian Casablancas' actions as songwriter and bandleader are speaking louder than his intentionally empty words.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed First Impressions of Earth by The Strokes. The Strokes begin a 17-city tour March 3rd. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Everybody sees me, but it's not that easy. Standing in the light field, waiting for some action, waiting for some action. Oh, but why won't you come over here?
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Caliph's House, A Year in Casablanca, an account of remodeling a dream house by travel writer Tahir Shaw. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from Capella University, offering degrees online in education, business, information technology, psychology, and human services at 1-888-CAPELLA. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Joe Biden, Democratic Senator from Delaware and a member of the Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Committees. We'll talk about hearings into the NSA surveillance program, the confirmation of Samuel Alito, the war in Iraq, divisions in Congress, and his possible run for president. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.